This week on Making Contact.
The security forces have been allowed to be judge, jury, and executioner in this country for far too many years.
It was May of 2010, and many Americans were planning their tropical summer getaways. Suddenly, the Caribbean nation of Jamaica was in the spotlight, but not for sunshine and sandy beaches. Instead, news images depicted gun battles in the streets of Kingston and police stations on fire. When the smoke cleared, at least 73 civilians were dead. The latest chapter in Jamaica's long-running history of police violence in the name of security.
There is a pattern of impunity when the police kill in Jamaica.
On this edition, we return to Jamaica for a closer look at 2010's West Kingston incursion. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
After a raid on the Tivoli Gardens slum, concern has been expressed about the high number of civilian deaths.
The spark that lit Kingston into flames was a United States extradition request for Christopher Koch. To his West Kingston neighborhood of Tivoli Gardens, he was a Robin Hood figure. A don who provided resources like jobs, school money, and protection against rival gangs. But to U.S. prosecutors, Koch was a dangerous organized criminal and a leader of an international drug and arms trafficking ring. When the Jamaican government issued a warrant for his arrest, residents of Tivoli Gardens barricaded the streets in protest. To confront the violent resistance, Prime Minister Bruce Golding declared a state of emergency in the capital city.
The state of emergency will enable the security forces to exercise extraordinary powers necessary to deal with this extraordinary situation.
In the days that followed, more than 70 civilians were killed in West Kingston before soldiers gained control of the neighborhood. It took another month before Christopher Koch was found. In the aftermath of that week of bloodshed, many Jamaicans demanded to know why so many people were killed in that operation and if the security forces had abused their power. They're still waiting for answers. Reporter Madeline Baer spent the summer of 2010 in Kingston documenting the long-running pattern of police killings with the organization Jamaicans for Justice. She brings us this story.
A week and a half after the state of emergency began, the streets of West Kingston no longer rained bullets, but now they bear the scars of war. Heavily armed soldiers inundated the area, in the backs of pickup trucks, standing watch atop apartment buildings, and guarding entry to many streets where they checked every bag for weapons. Yellow police tape surrounded the police station, which was set on fire during the chaos. So was Coronation Market, the commercial heartbeat of the neighborhood. Now, only stray dogs and curious children meandered through the concourse, pecking at the piles of rubble where wooden shops recently stood. That's the physical destruction. The human cost of the incursion was less visible. To find it, I went to the Tivoli Gardens Community Center. After dozens of people died in the recent gunfire, it took several days for the government to collect and catalog the bodies. Families were left wondering if their missing relatives were alive or dead. Here was where they could find out. Up a flight of stairs, past church pastors and funeral home workers, men and women gathered in a room and awaited their chance to view photos of the dead on a computer database. Paulette Wellington sat in the waiting area, holding a photo of her 29-year-old son, Sheldon.
They took my son out of my house and killed him, and he wasn't a gunman.
In the photograph, Sheldon wears jeans and a collared shirt. He leans to the side and looks off camera. Wellington said that because of a bad foot that left him partially disabled since childhood, he lived with her and her young daughter in a third-floor apartment near Tivoli Gardens. And last Sunday, just as things had begun to quiet down in West Kingston, she and Sheldon were cleaning when soldiers knocked on the door.
They asked if I was alone, and I said, no, I have my son. And they asked me to bring him into the other room. When I come in there with him, they ask his name, and he gives them his name. They say to him, you look like a gunman.
The soldiers told Paulette they wanted to take Sheldon to the station for questioning. It was the last time she saw him alive.
And since he went away, I've been searching for him.
Wellington walked across the city, from police stations to hospitals and back, asking everyone she met if they knew what happened to her son. On the fourth day, her worst fears were confirmed. She found Sheldon's body on a stretcher in a police station. Killed, she was told, with a gunshot to the pelvis after he attempted to disarm a soldier. The community center was filled with stories like this. Young women who witnessed soldiers shooting their brothers, wives whose husbands were taken from their arms. Questions, immense, grim questions, were on everyone's mind. One person searching for answers is Jamaican public defender Earl Witter. He set up an office in Tivoli Gardens in the immediate aftermath of the incursion and documented testimony of what residents witnessed.
Atrocities and unlawful homicides committed by members of the security forces.
Local and foreign news reporters heard the same thing, and soon the world's attention honed in on the inferno in the tropics. Amnesty International called for an investigation. So did Human Rights Watch, Jamaicans for Justice, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Witter shared his information with the Jamaica Constabulary Force.
These allegations should be investigated because they, on the face of them, appeared to be instances of extrajudicial killings.
Imagine that the police in New York killed 73 black men all at one time.
Carolyn Gomes leads the human rights organization Jamaicans for Justice.
The outrage in the black community. Imagine that the police in London killed 73 black men in Brixton or Birmingham in one killing spree lasting 3 days. Imagine how people would be marching, how people would be demanding accountability and justice.
But in Kingston, there was nothing of the sort. Not after television news depicted military trucks carrying piles of corpses. Not after the prime minister declared that 73 civilians had been killed. To understand the lack of outrage, Gomes says we need to look back at the country's history. The idea that some lives are worth less than others has deep roots in Jamaica's past.
Comes from the paradigm of the plantation, as people call it, comes from the paradigm of colonialism. The founding of the Jamaica Constabulary Force in 1865 was in response to an uprising of people for more rights.
Though slavery was officially abolished in 1834 and Jamaica won independence in 1962, the class divide of the plantation era has stubbornly persisted. Today, inner-city communities like Tivoli Gardens are a world away from the middle and upper-class gated neighborhoods in the Kingston Hills. The haves and the have-nots rarely cross paths. And according to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which of those groups you belong to largely determines how you are treated by the police and the justice system. In 2008, the commission visited Jamaica and reported that those killed by the police are overwhelmingly from poor backgrounds. Many of those victims, it found, were unarmed and posed no threat. But income, says Gomes, is only one part of the divide.
Onto this nasty kind of understanding of the world, we have put in political tribalism, which allowed one to hurt another person of the same class because they were of a different political persuasion.
In so-called garrison neighborhoods, gangs loyal to a political party or a drug cartel, or both, garner more respect than the police. Urban warfare in these communities earned Jamaica the distinction of being named Murder Capital of the World in 2005.
And what ends up is those communities become them for us who live outside of them, and we don't care what the police do.
So when security forces made their way into Tivoli Gardens in May of 2010, many commentators praised the government for what they saw as a long overdue response to the nation's crime problem, one that should be replicated in other parts of the country. And indeed, what began as a search for one man turned into a two-month crackdown on gangs and crime. Gomes has difficulty imagining that there will be any meaningful investigation into the Tivoli Gardens deaths. Her skepticism is rooted in experience. Since Jamaicans for Justice was founded, more than 2,000 Jamaicans have been killed by the police. This in a country with a population the size of Brooklyn.
The security forces have been allowed to be judge, jury, and executioner in this country for far too many years.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to a documentary on police violence in Jamaica, produced by Madeline Baer.
There may be no better place to understand the magnitude of police brutality than in Jamaicans for Justice's office, up an anonymous pockmarked Kingston Road. The bulk of their work consists of representing the families of victims of police killings, to make sure that their relative's death is thoroughly investigated and that if it was unwarranted, someone is held accountable. In a small back room, metal file cabinets contain a morbid archive of the Jamaican justice system. One file for each contentious death. Some include no more than a police report and a funeral program. Others are thick and messy, with news clippings and court documents. A few take up an entire drawer. These are the ones that rattled the consciousness of the country for months, even years. Brayton, where 7 boys and young men in a lone country house were killed. 13-year-old Janice Allen, musician Robert Hill. The files give a sense of not only the frequency of police killings, but the institutional dysfunction that allows the violence to continue. There are contradictory police reports, incomplete autopsies, unheeded requests for documents from police investigators.
There is a pattern of impunity when the police kill in Jamaica, and that there are many things which go into allowing for this pattern of impunity.
Susan Goff is a spokesperson with Jamaicans for Justice.
One of the major things being the failure of the investigative mechanisms to make it possible to put the best case forward before the courts.
That, she says, was the case with Jason Smith, who was beaten and killed in 2002 near his home in Spanish Town, a city just outside of Kingston. His mother, Monica Williams, and brother, Leonard Smith, tell his story.
He always went to bed early and wake up early in the morning.
We always play a lot and we always get along good.
He will come in my room, lay down beside me, play with me until he said, "Mommy, go make my breakfast for me." He dreamed to be a firefighter. So you must know he always at the fire station because we live next door.
And he also wanted to play football too, because he could play.
He's played for the school team, yeah. Normally when he play whether for the school or with the firemen, he always have a snack, and he is a lover of banana chips.
When him dead, yeah, the banana chips and the water was on there.
And because of that, I can't even eat banana chips, because as I take up one, I remember Jason.
When forced to explain the country's high number of police killings, Jamaican officials point to the country's extraordinary levels of violence, its unrepentant gangs and murderous drug lords who claim hundreds of lives every year and keep tourists far from the capital city. The argument implies that those killed by the police must have been gunmen, and their deaths mean fewer criminals on the street. But it's harder to make that case when the victims are 5, 10, or 15 years old. Between 2000 and 2010, approximately 30 children were killed by police bullets. Jason Smith was one of them.
At the time, I was 15 and I was 18.
On July 9th of 2002, Leonard, Jason, and some friends played a game of basketball in the late afternoon. As the sun began to set, Jason bicycled to the store to pick up a snack and then continued home. He passed the public market, carrying a plastic bag with banana chips and bottled water. At the same time, a large convoy of heavily armed police was traveling through Spanish Town.
Some shots were firing, and Jason heard the shots and jumped off the bicycle and ran.
When Jason ran, two officers chased him into a market stall where witnesses heard them beat him up.
I heard that when they run him down, they beat him, and then an ex-policeman run come around the corner and say, where the boy there, and shoot him.
That's essentially the cause of death, gunshot wound to the chest.
Dr. Ademola Odunfa has performed or observed more than 1,000 autopsies in Jamaica, including Jason's. From his cramped office in a Kingston hospital, he looked over the lengthy autopsy report he filled out 8 years ago.
But there are other additional blunt force injuries on the body. There was one on the right forearm, there was one on the right elbow, and then there was one on the left hip.
Even in a photograph from the funeral of Jason in the casket, wearing a bow tie and white flowers on his lapel, you can make out bruises on his forehead, left eye socket, and upper nose.
As well as a contusion on the right calf. It appears to me that he had been physically abused in the sense that he had some kicks and blows and other blunt injuries before he was finally shot in the chest.
At the time, Monica was visiting a friend in Florida. The next morning, she received a message saying she must call home.
And when I called, they said I have to come home because Jason's sick. They did not want to say what has happened to Jason.
She rushed home that same day. There had been a demonstration in the streets of Spanish Town the night before. Leonard and his uncle were arrested as they clamored in front of the police station. By the time Monica arrived in the morning, still unclear about exactly what had happened, her home was swarming with people.
And when I got here, the crowd I see at the gate, I know that something was wrong. Just looking on the amount of crowd at the gate, I figured that Jason died. Yeah.
Jamaicans for Justice's Susan Goff says that with so many extrajudicial killings in the country, it's hard to keep the public from becoming tired of the stories, from accepting them as routine. Just about every day, a brief in the newspaper tells of one more alleged shootout with the police, in which a civilian wound up dead.
It's easy when the figures come out, you know, at the end of a month or the end of a year, and you have a figure of 152 people killed by the police. It's easy to ignore that or to be more accepting of that if you don't, in fact, know who these people were.
Since her son's death, Monica has made it her life's mission to tell Jason's story to as many people as she can reach. It's a process that begins at home.
Sometimes talk about him day to day. You know, the type of person he was, jovial, helpful.
For Monica, her son is not a statistic.
He has a name, a face, a young, handsome, joyous one. Everyone in Spanish Town knows what it looks like. It's depicted on two murals in front of Monica's home. It's spray-painted on the roof of her car and tattooed on Leonard's arm. It appears in the memorial section of the newspaper every year on the anniversary of his death. And it fills pages of photo albums and files she keeps in her bedroom bureau.
For 8 years now, we have doing the memorial to keep the remembrance of Jason. We are preparing for it. So I wrote a letter this morning to the station to say if I can get the marching band to perform to the spot where they killed him.
As Monica recounts Jason's mannerisms, the details of his death, and even shares pictures of his funeral service, her voice never wavers. She's told the story hundreds of times to reporters, visitors, radio hosts, anyone who will listen. But that doesn't make it any easier.
Anyway, how I feel, I will call Miss Coombs or Miss Goff and say, you know, I feel this way, I feel that way. And then she will say, you know, Monica, we know it's not easy, but you have to try to deal with it. And, you know, Jason is not coming back. He's gone.
After a few minutes, she continues where she left off, despite the pain. It's all she can do to make sure Jason lives on in her memory.
I just think about anything what to bring Jason to everyone's attention. Some people ask, oh, who tell you about the marching band to do it with? I said, I just come up with it.
If they're seeing his face every year, if the newspapers publish a picture of him, it brings it back into the consciousness of the country that this is a child who was killed, and really there has been no justice for the family.
Monica knew that pursuing justice in a case of a police killing is an uphill battle. Cases can take years making their way through the court system. To persist takes the time, money, and emotional fortitude that most families just don't have. But Monica did. Her lawyer was a veteran human rights advocate. Members from Jamaicans for Justice joined her in court, and Leonard was at her side the whole way. But her greatest asset was her own perseverance.
She would call the clerk of the courts to find out the status of the case. She would call the BSI, and it was as though nobody was going to put her off. She was never daunted.
At one stage, when I was going to court, one of the policemen said to me, my son shoot at them and them kill the boy. And if me still come to court, what they will do? And I said, you can't do me nothing, right? You can't do me anything. And I went to the complaint office and lodged a complaint. I was not afraid. I was not afraid at all.
The legal proceeding began at the coroner's court, where a jury decides if anyone should be charged with murder. There, the jury found enough evidence to charge three officers in Jason's death. It was a rare, invigorating success.
This was the first case that we had in which the coroner's court actually said that a policeman should be charged for murder. So that gave us some hope at that point.
In 2005, now 3 years after Jason's death, Monica's lawyer presented the case to the criminal court. Evidence established that Jason was unarmed, that three officers were at the scene, and that shell casings found in the stall matched the gun of one of the officers. But what may have been a clear case was not so. Monica tried to explain the court's Kafkaesque verdict.
It was three of them fired that night, and the shot did not lodge in Jason, so they can't tell which gun shoot Jason. It came out that they don't hold any one of them accountable for the murder for Jason.
Got that? Because the court cannot determine which officer shot the fatal bullet, all three walked. As in many cases, the investigation by the police force itself did not provide enough evidence to convict their colleagues. Susan Goff was dismayed.
There was nothing to prompt the death of this boy. And then there was just this systematic resistance, poor collection of evidence, the long delays. And certainly through the criminal proceedings, there isn't a feeling of closure or justice.
They should send him to prison, you know, and then you'll feel a little better, you know. They send them back, set them free. So they're going to do it again to somebody else's child.
After exhausting her legal options in the criminal court, Monica took the case to civil court, where in 2010, a judge ruled that the government should compensate her for negligence and loss of life.
I don't know, you know, I really don't know where I get the strength from to do these things, but I just go through and just do it for Jason because we missed him.
On July 9th of 2010, the 8th anniversary of Jason's death, the government's crackdown on gangs had extended to Spanish Town, which was now under a state of emergency. Authorities prohibited Monica's family from holding their annual vigil, and the local police station declined her request for a marching band. But Monica never missed an anniversary, and so she and Leonard waited out the state of emergency. At the end of July, 3 weeks later than usual, with friends and family, members of Jamaicans for Justice, and one local reporter to cover the event, they marched from her home to the street where Jason was killed. Hey. Those calling out for proper investigations, for accountability, and for justice will find a brutal lesson in the story of Jason Smith. If Monica, with overwhelming perseverance and a veteran lawyer, couldn't get justice for the death of her son, what are the chances that the families of those victims will? The week after the incursion, Prime Minister Golding gave a speech to Parliament. He pledged that proper investigations would be carried out to determine the cause of each death in Tivoli Gardens. But Jamaicans for Justice's Carolyn Gomes points out that the government already missed that opportunity.
What kind of investigation can be proper when bodies have been moved without the scene being preserved, when shells have been removed, where people's hands have not been swabbed, where you will never be able to assign responsibility for individual deaths? I would almost put my head on a block that we will never assign accountability and responsibility to individual members of the security forces for those deaths.
There's no word on those investigations the Prime Minister promised. The Jamaica Constabulary Force did not respond to requests for an interview for this story. In the meantime, Witter has charged his own office with determining the exact number of deaths that occurred in West Kingston and who is responsible for them.
And the reason we have set ourselves this task is because there was a not dissimilar operation back in 2001. And to this day, we don't know just how many persons died as a result of those activities. Not so this time, if we have anything to do with it.
When the gunfire subdued in West Kingston and Koch was eventually found and extradited to New York, the story largely faded from American newspapers and television sets. That's just not right, says Carolyn Gomes.
Americans should care. Canadians should care. British should care. The drugs that are being fueling some of this are smoked and snorted up north. Not here, for the most part.
And of course, U.S. policy gives Americans another reason to care. After all, it was the U.S. government's extradition request for Koch that triggered the state of emergency. When he was caught, State Department officials applauded Jamaican authorities for what they called bold steps that they took to apprehend him. And while smoke was still clearing from the Kingston unrest, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with Caribbean leaders in Barbados to launch a new anti-narcotics initiative for the region. The Obama administration has stressed that promoting security and social justice are just as important as cracking down on drugs. But there are concerns that, as with similar U.S. initiatives in Mexico and Colombia, those tens of millions of dollars in aid may only put more Jamaican lives on the front lines of a drug war with no end in sight. For Making Contact, I'm Madeline Baer in Kingston, Jamaica.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Today's show was adapted from a three-part video documentary produced in partnership with the organization Jamaicans for Justice and with support from the University of California at Berkeley's Human Rights Center and the European Union. The series is called Victims' Voices, and you can find a link to it on our website, radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Kyungjin Lee and George Lavender, producers, Irene Flores, web editor, Steph St. Clair, development associate, Lisa Bartfai and Megan Lasala, production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, Salima Hamarani, Alton Bird, Catherine Lee, and Daishal Moore, volunteers. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.